From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
This morning, we speak first with science journalist Lee Billings. Lee is a senior editor from Scientific American magazine who talks about the many fascinating elements of space, from solar storms to the possibility of a new planet and everything in between.
Then local resident Brett Trowbridge is the CEO of a company called TRS Group. It uses scientific innovation to clean up contaminants in the soil and the water, all through thermal remediation. That's all coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
White dwarfs, novas, space junk, solar storms, and what? A new planet? We speak this morning with science journalist Lee Billings. He can get you excited to look into the night sky like no one else can. And that's why we love to have him join us. His writing specializes in astronomy, physics, planetary science, and space flight. And he's a senior editor at Scientific American. Lee Billings, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
It's delightful to be here this morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're really excited to have you. And we might as well start with, okay, from where did you see the eclipse last week?
So very New York moment. I had to do a spot with MSNBC with Katie Turr. They had a live broadcast they did where they had correspondents throughout the entire seatbelt like sash that cuts across, you know, from Mazatlan, Mexico, all the way up to Maine. And in their home base in New York in Rockefeller Center, I was there, and they had set up this live shot, this elaborate live shot. We were going to be outside. And then I'm kind of revealing behind the scenes here. Maybe it's bad, but what happened is they realized right before the shot happened that they were on the wrong side of the building. And so we were in the shadow of Rockefeller Center, and we couldn't directly see the eclipse. But what was awesome, we got 92% coverage. So we saw all the effects. We saw, you know, the sky get kind of gloomy, kind of dusky. We saw lots of people down in the street stopping traffic and looking up with their eclipse glasses. And traffic never stops. People never stop on the street in New York City. But the best part was I looked up and I could see glinting in the reflection of a skyscraper window nearby, I could see the disk of the sun. And so I put my glasses on, I looked up, and I saw it happen off a skyscraper. So very New York City moment. That's how I saw it. Now, did either of you get to see the eclipse?
Neither of us did. No. Unfortunately, and we were scrambling at the last moment, like a lot of people probably were too.
Right.
To go and do it. But by that point, it was so expensive, you know? And so we'll just have to get it next time, hopefully in a far off land.
Well, you know, that's the thing. Next time's going to be what? And it's like basically 20 years from now, 2044, 2045. The next one, though, I think is in 2026 in Spain. So that might be kind of nice. Who wants to go? You know, maybe we'll go to Spain, right?
Yeah, that's right. Why not? Well, speaking of looking up into the sky at interesting moments in time, there's a really interesting thing that's going to happen sometime between now and September. And this is a nova. We'll be able to see it sort of within this crown, the Corona Borealis, which explain to us, you know, what a nova is, how it's distinguished from a supernova, and what are we going to see?
So this is really cool. This is really cool. And full disclosure, guys, I had no idea this was going to happen until I read, you know, like a blog post about it a few months back, and I got really excited. So there is a star called T. Coronae Borealis. It's about 3,000 light years from Earth. And we have found humanity, not us personally, humanity have found that this thing erupts in a nova about once every 80 years or so. And we'll get into why that happens. But it is actually two stars. It's a little tiny white dwarf, which is about the size of Earth. It's a little stellar remnant. What our sun will eventually turn into after it kind of, you know, blows up all its outer atmosphere and fades to this little ember. And it's also a big puffy red giant star, which is what our sun will be when it nears the end of its life before it becomes a white dwarf. So you have to imagine little tiny white dwarf, big puffy red giant star twirling around each other 3,000 light years away in the constellation Corona Borealis. So the little tiny white dwarf sucks a bunch of gas from the puffy red giant star, and it snows down onto the surface. And every now and then, every 8 years or so, it sucks enough stuff on there that it all blows up at once. It gets unstable and it blows up, and it blows off the entire outer surface of the white dwarf, but it doesn't destroy the white dwarf. And that's a nova. It's not a supernova. Supernova is much bigger, much stronger, and it just blows everything to smithereens. This thing keeps the white dwarf intact so it can go doing its kind of stellar vampirism again and again and again. And the reason why it's interesting is because this process is actually how things like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and maybe lithium emerge in the universe. So elements are produced, chemical elements are produced in these sorts of explosions. And it's going to happen, we know, sometime between now and September. The last one was in 1946. And so it's every 80 years or so. I mean, I guess in theory, maybe it'll disappoint everybody and happen next year instead. But odds are it's going to happen. And you'll be able to see it in the sky for a couple of days and for a few weeks with binoculars.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Lee Billings. He is a science journalist who writes about astronomy, physics, planetary science, and spaceflight. And he is also the senior editor at Scientific America. All right, Lee, I am fascinated with this search for Planet Nine. Years ago, when I was in college, one of my physics professors and I were having a conversation about the Nemesis star, which was this theory that there was this big star or body orbiting outside the Oort cloud, and every few million years it would disturb the Oort cloud, causing material to come towards the sun, resulting in comets, meteorites, etc. Is Planet Nine the same idea, or what is it?
So it is a similar idea. And the big idea is that space is big. Space is big and dark. And there's lots out there that we don't see and we don't know, even right next to us, even right here in the solar system. The Oort cloud you mentioned, that is a big spherical shell of comets we believe exists around the solar system and kind of forms the outer boundary of the sun's gravitational influence. It's where the sun's just barely hanging on to these comets and things that have been flung out by Jupiter from and other giant planets from early in the solar system's life. And we don't actually see the Oort cloud. We infer its existence. We know it's there because we can see and trace the orbits of these comets that come back in every now and then from around this, from way out there and circle the sun. And they're knocked down usually by passing stars. That's how far out they are. Now, we're talking about how we infer the existence of the Oort cloud. No one doubts the Oort cloud exists. Sometimes you see other strange patterns in objects out there. There was an object called Sedna that was discovered back in the day. It's a dwarf planet. And what's really weird about Sedna is it's way, 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 way past Pluto. And in fact, it never gets closer to the sun than I think about 11 billion miles, something like that. And so what that means is you have to imagine this thing on an orbit. It's twirling around in basically like a circle. But one end of the circle, the closest end of the circle, is 11 billion miles from the sun. And the other one's much further out. It's a stretched out oval. And so that the orbit is. And so how did it get there? How did it get way out there? Well, one of the best ideas is that something threw it out there, because it's really hard to form things that far away, that far out from the sun, based on how slow they're moving. The further out you are, the slower you're moving in your orbit, the more space you have to go through. And so people were able to look at these patterns of objects, various objects they found out there, and they said, okay, all these objects seem to kind of share this vague alignment, this kind of common pattern. I don't think we really need to get into the details. It gets kind of complicated. But the gist is that there are these patterns of orbits of certain objects out there, and they suggest that something big out there, about the size of Neptune maybe, is pushing them around. And that's the best explanation. But the thing is, we can't find it. And astronomers have been looking since 2016 at least, which is when the kind of definitive Planet Nine paper came out. They've also been looking for Nemesis too, the Nemesis star you mentioned. We haven't seen that yet. Not saying it's not out there, but I think odds are Nemesis probably isn't out there. Maybe it's a brown dwarf or something, some dim big object. But Planet Nine, on the other hand, again, might be the size of Neptune, maybe a super Earth. And they've been looking since 2016. They have an idea of where the orbit should be based upon all these other patterns they've seen. And they've actually crossed off pretty definitively about 75% of that orbital path. You think about the path in space, it sweeps out, and they've looked about 75% of it and they haven't found it. So that remaining 25% or so is interesting. That's probably where it is if it exists. But the trouble is this swath of its orbit, this 25%, is also backdropped by the Milky Way, the disk of the Milky Way. And what's in the Milky Way? What's in the Milky Way disk? Lots and lots of stars. So it's really tough to see a tiny little dot of light. That's how they're going to find it. Tiny little dot of light just kind of drifting and slightly moving between the fixed stars, the background stars. And when you're doing that, when the whole background is just tons and tons of stars, it's really tough to do. But we'll probably find it soon if it exists. There's things called the Rubin Observatory. There's a few other things, space telescopes as well, NASA's Roman Space Telescope. These things are going to be having very high, wide fields of view, like a big wide field of view camera or a panoramic camera. And they're going to stare at the sky over and over and over and take snapshots. And that way they'll be able to see little tiny things moving around much better than we can now. So we should find it soon if we find it at all.
Well, speaking of things that are within our solar system, what is the latest on the OSIRIS-REx mission and the data and the studying they've been doing on the material?
That is a great, great question. So there's a lot going on with OSIRIS-REx. You know, the thing is the mission in a way is over. The primary mission, right? It went to this asteroid Bennu, this chunk of primordial stuff that is some of it older than the sun itself. It went there. It gathered its samples. It brought them back to Earth. The samples came back to Earth in their capsule and were recovered successfully by NASA and taken to a specialized center to be investigated. They opened up the canister. They saw what was inside. Now what they're doing is they are looking at all that material that was brought back, that precious material, that pristine stuff that is essentially, it's like a history book of the entire solar system that's just been held in deep cold storage for billions of years. And they're looking at it and they're using forensics. Basically, they're looking at different elemental ratios and things and trying to figure out, well, what is the history of this stuff? What is it telling us? And it's telling us some very curious things. One of the most curious things is it's looking like Bennu is this, you know, this little chunk of primordial stuff. It looks like Bennu actually used to be part of what might have been a protoplanet or even like a maybe even like a dwarf planet. It's hard to say exactly, but what it looks like is we see signs of liquid water flowing. We see signs of, there's something in particular called, there's phosphate that's in there, and oh, who cares about phosphate? Well, phosphate is typically associated with lots of water. And so some people have even speculated, even the principal investigator of OSIRIS-REx, Dante Loretta, has speculated that perhaps Bennu is a fragment of a lost, long gone ocean world. What does that mean? Well, no one really knows exactly what that means, but we do know that in the solar system's past, whether it's something like Planet Nine potentially being formed close to the sun and then flung out far away, or whether it's something like a lost world that was shattered by a great impact. We know these things happen. It was a terrible place of violence that gave rise to the wonderful thing we see today, but it was a tough time getting there. So stay tuned about OSIRIS-REx. There's a lot of exciting stuff to come, and it is literally rewriting our history of the solar system as we speak.
Wow, that's exciting stuff. Lee, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking you're so excited about this stuff, and you live in the city. You mentioned that, you know, you talked about New York City, live in New Jersey now, but, you know, out here in Utah, we're really lucky. We can see the night sky. How Yes. do you see the night sky there? What do you do? I picture that every single night you've got to see the night sky because you're so enthused about it.
Well, I wish I could say that. You know, normally I'm pretty strapped with dealing with my two youngsters, my 4 and 8 year old, for, you know, bedtime and stuff. And by the time that it's really dark and they're put to bed, I'm just, oh, I just need to lay on the couch usually, or lay face down on the floor. That's more my speed.
Love
but it is true that the light pollution is not great out here. So most of the time when you imagine me looking up at the sky and wonder, most of the time it's more like I'm looking at the sky and there's this little tear of sadness rolling down my cheek. But you know, now that I'm out in Jersey, actually, the view is much, 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 much better. Comparatively speaking, I would look up at the sky in New York. I could see maybe 5 stars. I could literally count them on one hand.
Wow.
And here in Jersey, I can see a lot of stuff. I can see most constellations. I say hi to Orion every fall. Hey, Orion, coming up in the sky. I see Venus in the sky in the morning and the dusk. I have a small telescope and binoculars. And, you know, the real tough part is I can look through it and I can be enthused, but so much of it is about the next generation, about that sense of wonder in children, for instance. And, you know, it's tough sometimes to get them to pay attention and look through the viewfinder when they just want to look at their Pokemon.
Yeah. Last weekend, I was down in southern Utah where it's really good star viewing. And sure enough, we saw a little line of SpaceX satellites going by, which is, it's weird in some ways that that is what draws your eye to the night sky. And it's this artificial, it's this thing, but it is fascinating at the same time. And, we've talked recently on the show about space junk and how many satellites are being put up there, and what does that mean for when this space junk starts falling out of the sky? And there was an incident in the last, I don't know, what, week or so in Florida. Can you tell us about it?
Oh, wow. So lots to unpack there. I too love to watch the SpaceX Starlink trails, which are only temporary as they go into their permanent orbits, right? Or their working orbits. So they don't, it's not like they're all across the sky all the time, but oh, I love seeing them. They're gorgeous little strings of pearls or diamonds in the sky. They're up in low Earth orbit. That's how they work. The reason why they're so cool is that they're not that far away, relatively speaking. If you could just drive straight up, it's not really that far. Of course, you can't do that. But the point is that light can travel really easily. So you can get really high speed internet because they're circling and in low Earth orbit all the time and always in touch with ground stations versus things that are much higher up, like geosynchronous orbits that are far, far higher up and have a much longer lag time for signals. So you can't do your Call of Duty online gaming using a geosynchronous satellite. That's where you need Starlink. Well, another thing that's up in low Earth orbit is the International Space Station. And that's actually the biggest thing in low Earth orbit. And back in March 2021, the astronauts on the International Space Station, this biggest thing in low Earth orbit, jettisoned the biggest thing they've ever thrown out of the International Space Station, which was a big pallet. A very large pallet that contained a couple of metric tons of spent batteries. And it's kind of complicated how that ended up happening. There are good reasons as to why they did that. It makes sense. It was a sound decision. And they did a bunch of modeling beforehand saying, okay, this huge multi-ton pallet full of spent batteries, heavy spent batteries, nickel hydride batteries, that's probably going to just re-enter the Earth's atmosphere and burn up like typical space trash. No big deal. Well, March, fast forward 3 years later, last month, there was a fellow, I don't think he was home at the time, but basically, a 2 pound molten cylinder of kind of metallic cylinder slammed through his roof and punched a hole through the floor and almost hit his son. And, they go and look at this thing. What is this smoldering thing in this little crater? It's this metallic object. You can look at the estimated reentry time because we do track things up there. They were able to track this battery pallet and figure out when it was going to be coming in and generally where, looking at its trajectory and notional debris field, if there were parts of it that didn't entirely burn up. And lo and behold, it all matched up. It was very, very, very suspicious. And so NASA came and they collected this piece with the homeowner, cooperation. They collected this piece of potential space junk and they took it to the nearby Kennedy Space Center and they analyzed it. And lo and behold, they just actually just, I think on Monday, they officially announced that yes, this was a piece from that battery pallet. It was a stanchion that was on the battery pallet rather than one of the batteries themselves. And it was made of an high temperature alloy called Inconel, which is re the main reason why it survived reentry. And really the bigger takeaway here is that we can't keep treating low Earth orbit like a junkyard. There's just too many valuable assets up there, whether it's the International Space Station, whether it's the Starlink satellites, whatever it is. And similarly, we can't keep assuming that every single time something reenters the atmosphere, it's just going to burn up or it's just going to fall in the ocean. And my final point here is that even if it all burns up in the atmosphere, that is increasingly seeming like a problem. I believe NOAA and a few other institutions have done things like take high altitude samples of air from the stratosphere. And you know what they found? They found oodles and oodles of things like does trying to think of some of the actual compounds, but basically metals, vaporized metals, atoms of metal. In crazy amounts relatively above the background up there. And what does that mean? What's that going to do? Well, we aren't exactly sure yet, but we're seeing this change very fast, this very delicate part of the Earth system. And so even if everything burns up there, that may not be good.
So, how do you explain that space junk colliding through your house to your home insurance company? I'm sure that's going to be a very interesting conversation.
Well, it is actually, and it's a Wild West environment. It's actually really good that NASA was able to show that this came from their equipment, because that does mean NASA and the U.S. by proxy is responsible according to the laws that regulate this, which are somewhat threadbare, basically going all the way back to the UN Outer Space Treaty, which is from the 1960s. And so any nation that launches something into space, whether it's, or like, you know, if SpaceX is based in the United States, if SpaceX launches something and something goes wrong, well, it's SpaceX's problem, but it's also the United States government's problem. So it's good that NASA was able to trace this, but if it had come from, let's say, China, China has very big rockets that some of their rocket bodies, their upper stage fairings will just fall back to Earth uncontrolled through the atmosphere. And those can land anywhere essentially along their path. And we've gotten very lucky that it hasn't hit someplace nasty yet. You know, it hasn't hit the Louvre in Paris, or it hasn't hit the White House. These are remote possibilities, but they could happen. And if they do happen, it's not clear how you get compensation from China in that case, because they're technically not really, it gets very tricky about who has blame there and how it's going to work. But in this case, the homeowner has a good claim and will get the roof and the floor repaired on the government's dime.
Well, let's go back to the solar eclipse. For the scientists that actually looked directly at the sun instead of the reflection in the mirror, instead of the reflection in the building, which is such a funny story, what did they discover? Anything unique or new or unexpected during the eclipse? Because I know there are a number of scientists that were looking for things you can't normally see.
So, you know, I want to say something in good faith here, right? Which is that science is a process of incremental learning, and the sun, of course, has secrets still to tell us. But I'm just going to push back a little bit. Like, this notion that somehow watching a solar eclipse is going to just unleash and reveal transformative new knowledge, that's a line. And I'm not trying to belittle it. I'm not trying to say that it's not important. But what have we discovered from looking at this solar eclipse? Pretty highly technical stuff, I would guess, if anything, about the sun. I mean, that doesn't mean that again, there's nothing there. And it's a little too early, I think, to say. I think a lot of folks are still in data analysis phase. But, you know, things that they were looking at are things like, okay, how does the sun's outer corona, its outer atmosphere, how does that look different now than it did in 2017, when we had the last great American solar eclipse? In 2017, the sun was near the lull, the minimum of its 11-year activity cycle. And now in 2024, it's nearing the maximum. And so when in 2017 we looked at it, things were pretty sedate and calm. The corona, this diaphanous glowing halo of light around the sun that you can't normally see because it's too dim compared to how bright the sun is. When the moon slides over the sun's face, you can see it very well. It was very calm and almost featureless. When we saw it this time, there are lots of features, lots of swirls and wisps almost jet-like features. And we know what those are. We have a good sense of how they come to be, but there's still fundamental questions. One of the most fundamental ones is how and why is the corona so hot? The corona is millions of degrees in temperature. The sun's visible surface is thousands of degrees in temperature. And you think, well, so what? Well, it's really weird. It's basically like, one way to think about it is if I had like a cup of hot tea and I was holding it in my hand, well, my hand would get hot, right? But it wouldn't suddenly vaporize into atoms. That's kind of the relationship we're seeing between the sun's surface and the corona. It's just the difference. It cannot be explained by thermal conduction of heat. There's something else going on. And what that something else is, we don't really know. It probably deeply connects to the magnetic fields that wind throughout the entire sun and control a lot of its activity. And the reason why we care is because that affects us here on Earth. Whenever a big magnetic field line snaps and pops and sends out a big bubble of gas and particles that might hit Earth, if it does hit Earth, that can cause nasty solar storms here that affect satellite communications, affect GPS, affect financial transactions, even affect whether or not you can get gas at the gas station. So it can be very, very, very nasty. And we need to know how that works, and we need to be able to predict it better. And that's part of why we study it like this.
That is so interesting. Okay, final question. We could talk to you all day, I think, Lee, but
yeah, sorry.
We're unfortunately out of time. But I wanted to just get your take briefly on, you know, people talk a lot about the Carrington event that happened in the 19th century. And I forget what year that happened.
1859. I had to look it up myself before I came on. Yeah, 1859.
And the probability, the possibility of another, you know, major solar storm event happening. I mean, it seems like it, the predictability, and maybe helped by being able to view the corona during the eclipse. I don't know, but what are chances for that?
It's a certainty. It's just a question of when. And what's really scary is so there's two things that are really scary. I'll try to not scary too much. One thing that's really scary is back in 1859, one way that we knew this was happening wasn't just the beautiful, dazzling auroral displays in the sky. And you can think about people being down in Florida and seeing aurora in the sky. You know, oh, it's the Northern Lights, but you're seeing it in Florida. Why is that? It's because there's a solar storm engulfing our planet, and you know, the atmosphere being excited by these powerful electric currents that are raised because our Earth is in some sense a kind of giant magnet, right? An electromagnet. And so you have these big currents washing over it, it generates sympathetic currents, and then you get these displays in the sky. But another way they figured it out was that telegraph wires caught on fire and set telegraph stations ablaze. And that's because of the amount of energy they were absorbing from these natural currents that were moving through our whole planet. Well, that was in 1859. We barely had anything back then. What do we have now? We have essentially built, as one scientist told me many years ago, we have essentially built a big catcher's mitt with all our electronic infrastructure. And we're just waiting for the sun to send a fastball towards us to catch it. And when we catch it, and we will at some point, it could be awful. The other reason, and we'll get to predictions very quickly, the other reason this is very scary is the Carrington event did this, and it was nasty, but there are other events. There's evidence for other events that are orders of magnitude stronger. They're called Miyake events after the first person who discovered them. We have not witnessed one of these in recorded history, but we can see in prehistory, there are records as well in tree rings and in ice cores. We can see these events. And how do we see them? Well, when the Earth takes a big wallop from the sun, it will generate it'll hit it so hard, essentially, that it'll make molecules in the atmosphere shatter apart and change into new kinds of forms. And so we can see this thing called carbon-14, which is radioactive and has a half-life and decays, and we can therefore track its timing and such. We can connect it to tree rings and get a nice chronology, a calendar of when things happen. And we can see that there's been about at least 10 of these Miyake events that have occurred. And again, all we're really seeing is just these little isotopes, these little carbon-14 spikes in the tree rings, in the ice cores. The ice cores are actually beryllium, not carbon, but whatever. And so we don't know what exactly caused them, but it's probably the sun. And if it is the sun, then it's very scary because it says that the sun can burp out these things that are much, 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 much stronger than the Carrington event. And yet the Carrington event itself, if it hit us, would be catastrophic. So if you imagine a Miyake event hitting us instead of a Carrington event, well, I mean, it's literally lights out. It's literally, wow. Oh, well, maybe we'll be back to the dark ages for a while. And I, you know, that sounds really catastrophist, but that seems to actually be the physical truth. So pretty scary.
Pretty scary. And we're worried about Russian and Chinese hackers working over our electronic infrastructure. Wow. Okay. Well, Lee Billings, senior editor at Scientific American, it's been such a pleasure hearing from you today. We didn't even get to a lot of the things we're going to talk about, so we'll have you back on.
I hope so. I blather a bunch, so my apologies there, but I had a great time. I you can tell I love to talk about this, and I love talking about it with both of you.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Well, as we know from hosting Cool Science Radio and just being around town, there's no shortage of local residents doing interesting things in science and technology. Our next guest, Brett Trowbridge, is one of those people. He's a local resident and the CEO of a company called TRS Group. Now, this company goes around the globe and cleans up PFAS, that is, those forever chemicals known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, for the treatment of soils, groundwater, and more. TRS Group is also, interestingly, a 100% employee-owned company with joint ventures and partnerships in Brazil, China, and Europe. Brett Trowbridge joins us now to tell us more. Brett, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
As I said, we like to talk to local people about the interesting things that they do. And you told me once about your business, and I had no idea that something like this existed. But let's start back with what PFAS are. I mean, I think I know of them as things like Teflon that are, you know, are used to coat pans and things like that. But I think they exist in large industry. Is that right? And they are left behind in soils and water?
Yes. And the things you think of Teflon are built from some of these PFAS compounds. So they go into hundreds of different products and chemicals. Teflon, the foam you see sprayed on fires at airports and things like that. So they're very strong and durable compounds, and they also don't degrade. And so they stay around for a long time. And they're toxic. And you may know them from the Dark Waters film, which was aired about 5 years ago, that highlighted some of the problems with the PFAS compounds.
Right. I also have seen them called fluorocarbons. And it's funny that in the news here in Park City, most recently, we've heard of fluorocarbons in our ski wax, and trying to rid the world of those has been a little effort locally. Is that something that sounds familiar to you?
It is, yeah. I mean, they make really strong products and chemicals because the carbon and the fluorine bonds are extremely durable, more durable than hydrocarbon bonds. So it makes them very useful in products like the ski wax and in you know, other things like Teflon.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Brett Trowbridge. He is a local resident and CEO of a company called TRS Group. Well, Brett, so these PFAS, are they only localized, aside from, you know, ski slope snow, are they only localized in manufacturing areas, say, you know, where a company was making something?
Typically they are, or where they were used. If they're used in the fluorinated foams at a firefighting facility or Department of Defense facility, then of course they get on the ground and they can spread. They also get burned like in a fire, and then they can spread in the air. So there's now data that they're in most drinking water supplies in the United States and around the world because they're so ubiquitous, and because they don't break down, because they've been used so much.
So I was just going to ask, how do they affect humans and how do they get into our system? Well, drinking water obviously sounds like one. What are the other ways that these PFAS affect the environment besides just making the soil that they're in toxic?
The primary toxicity is when they get into the human body, either through groundwater or other sources, you know, off the Teflon. You know, old Teflon pans didn't work as well as we all thought. So as you cooked with them, it would release PFAS compounds, so you could get them from the Teflon pans. There's obviously a revolution now to get rid of those pans, but you get them a number of different ways. Those are two of some of the primary ways: drinking water and Teflon pans.
So what TRS Group then does is goes in and cleans up these substances, whether it's in soil or water. And wow, what a diversity of services. I mean, cleaning up soil is one thing. Cleaning up water is a completely different thing. So this all has to do with thermal conduction in heating up the soil and or water. Can you explain in layperson's terms?
Yeah, essentially the core technology we started with that got us into the treatment of PFAS was electrical resistance heating. So we put electricity in the ground, we're able to run it, the current through the ground, and then we're able to heat it up and steam out or destroy contaminants in soils and in groundwater.
Okay, so I think in my research, I saw some other ways and other maybe technologies that were also used to treat these soils and water, probably electrification first. But, you know, historically, what have been the ways that effectively clean up the soil and water from PFAS?
So what we do is the soil is at a normal temperature, an ambient temperature. And as we put the electricity in and we heat it up, we get it to the boiling point of water. And so we steam the water out, that strips most chemicals out. And then we're able to remove those as a vapor. We actually put the whole area, manufacturing area, under vacuum, and we pull that vapor out. And then we treat that vapor above the ground so then it can be just discharged to the atmosphere. And then you end up at the end of that process with clean soil and clean groundwater.
So with the material that you're vaporizing into the atmosphere, or discharging into the atmosphere, obviously that's got to be safe. So how does the vaporization break down these chemicals? Because I would think that if you're just going to, you know, my mind is burning them off or they just become a toxic smoke. But what you're saying is they actually break apart into what, their elemental components?
So sometimes they break apart and we destroy them in the subsurface. More typically, we're volatilizing them, bringing them up as a vapor, and then either destroying them on site by burning them until they're completely destroyed, or we put them on activated carbon and that goes off site where it's then destroyed. So the chemicals ultimately get destroyed either in place, on site with our treatment system, or off site where they're burned.
So I'm trying to envision how you do this. Is it sticking giant electrodes down into the soil? Is it heated tubes? How do you heat the soil to that temperature? That's got to be a lot of energy expenditure just right there.
It is, and you're exactly right. They're electrodes. So we build electrodes in the ground. They're spaced 15 to 20 feet apart, and then we put the power into the ground, or with some newer technologies, we can actually put the heat in the ground and take it to higher temperatures, and that's a thermal conduction heating. So we have two versions now of our electrical heating, a lower temperature one for heating to the boiling point of water, and then one to go at higher temperatures that then allows us to treat PFAS and other higher boiling compounds.
So Brett, how long have we had PFAS as the byproduct of industry?
Ooh, it was a long time. I think DuPont first developed it maybe 80 years ago or so. Don't hold me to the exact date, but it's been around for a long time, and Teflon pans have been around for a long time.
Right, as long as I can remember anyway.
Right. And,
I'm no spring chicken either. So the PFAS have been really building up in soil and water for a long time. I would imagine that it's not been 80 years or however long that we really knew that there was an issue with them remaining in the soils. And we talked a little bit about how they affect the human. And I know they're related to some cancers and maybe they disrupt our hormones. But how was it first discovered that these PFAS are detrimental?
You know, it was a fair amount of scientific research going on 50 and 60 years ago. There was also some anecdotal evidence of people who had problems drinking water that were near some of the manufacturing facilities that DuPont had and 3M had up in Minnesota. So through, you know, a number of different directions, the scientific community and the EPA started to figure out that they were not only somewhat toxic, were extremely toxic and detrimental to human health, but it takes a while for scientists to go figure it out and, you know, point the finger and then figure out, no, it really is true that the PFAS compounds cause those problems.
Right. So was it in one of those stories that, you know, we recall, like Aaron Brockovich, or, you know, one of these stories where you hear the cases come out, someone is the whistleblower, and the story blows up into something that can no longer be ignored?
That's exactly how it happened with PFAS compounds. And it happened in a manufacturing facility in West Virginia, where DuPont was releasing some of the PFAS derivative compounds in the manufacturing process. And it was impacting human health and the environment, people who were drinking the water, cattle that were drinking the water, and they became the original source. And it's a worthy watch to go see the Dark Waters movie, because it tells that whole story better than I could do in a few short minutes.
So with this, let's go back to the land that you can remediate. I'm envisioning, you know, stripping everything out of it. Is that land usable again? Can it be turned into a healthy, viable soil after your work with it?
Yeah, the answer is yes. When we go in and treat a site, and we heat it. Typically, we have to develop a whole plan, get approval from the regulatory agencies. They buy in. And then at the end, when we're done, we go back and sample the soil and the groundwater and make sure we actually achieve the objectives. So then it can be turned over, and some of the property we've used goes back into industrial use, some into business use, others into even homes and developments, because now the soil's clean and the groundwater's clean and it's met the regulatory requirements.
Well, in reading through your website, a lot of what you tout is the fact that companies won't have to haul off the toxic soils anymore. You can come in and do this work. Well, here in Park City, as you know, there's a lot of conversation around all the toxic soils. And could your company or the work that you do, could that help eliminate some of the toxic soils around Park City? Or is that a different toxin that we're looking at?
You know, I don't know the specific chemicals that are there. It's likely we could treat some of those, but I don't know if we could treat all of them. But we'd have to evaluate that, obviously, in more detail. But yeah, that's typically what we go in, and sometimes underneath buildings. You don't even have to tear the buildings down. We can do it without tearing down the buildings, heat it up, clean it up, and then it can go back to the use that it had or to a new use. So that could really theoretically happen at the high school as well.
So then let's talk about water. I'm trying to envision what sorts of water, bodies of water you treat. Is it a big holding pond that's full of toxic water, or is it through a river? I mean, water moves a lot of times and soil doesn't. So how do you approach a body of water to treat?
Yeah, we can't really treat lakes or rivers because they flow too fast. We can't heat them up. But the water we typically treat is groundwater, and that can be anywhere from 5 feet below the surface to 100 feet below the surface. So we put our electrodes down into both the soil, and then if the groundwater is contaminated, into the groundwater, and we can treat both of those at the same time. And we typically boil the groundwater and then remove the contaminants from it through the boiling process.
That's just fascinating. And, you know, to think about, I think I read there's something like 9,000 different chemicals that go into making these PFAS. Mm-hmm. Again, for our listeners, I may be pronouncing it wrong, but per and polyfluoroalkyl substances. Did I say that right, Brett?
Close. Perfluoroalkyl substances is the general name. It really just means they're fluorinated compounds attached to alkyl, which is carbon, hydrocarbon compounds that are combined together. And that's what makes them so durable. But yeah, you got
okay. Okay. Well, you know, this is the thing that characterizes the PFAS is, you know, they are called forever chemicals, in quotes. And it makes me think, like, going back to Katie's question about toxic mine waste. I mean, I would assume that there has to be some other, you know, sort of procedure or whatever it is, but forever chemicals sound like they're going to be a lot harder to remove and remediate than, you know, just your average lead and arsenic and those sorts of things from mine waste. But we don't want to jump to any assumptions here about, you know, a town like Park City, but really, I mean, it costs millions and millions and millions of dollars to remove soils, to take them to, you know, a place out in Tooele, for example, to remove the mine waste if you're going to build in that area. And it's really thwarted a lot of development here in town. I don't know if you know, companies like TRS Group are looking into those sorts of things, you know, especially in the West where there's a lot of mine waste.
There are a lot of mine waste. We don't typically treat mine waste. We are looking at a few new technologies, but we haven't commercialized those yet. But you know, mining waste are like PFAS compounds because they're there forever. We just don't have as many mine sites as we have PFAS compounds around because they're so much more ubiquitous. But there's a lot of mining sites that need to be treated as well.
Well, one of the interesting features of your business is that, so you're the CEO, but this is a 100% employee-owned company, which I find to be pretty astonishing, especially for a global company to be employee-owned. Tell us how that came about and what that took to do.
Yeah, the founders and I were looking for a way to transition our business. And you know, one option is just to sell it to another owner and then they would take it over. But we really had great employees and we wanted to find a way to include them in the process. So the ESOP, which stands for Employee Stock Ownership Plan, allowed us to put a plan together over time that we could sell our stock to the employees and they could get that over time and the company would fund that process. So they don't have to buy it. It gets funded by the health of the company buying the stock and then putting it into the employees' accounts, and then it's in their retirement accounts. And it allows them to build that over time if they stay with the company. So for us, it was a great way for us to transition without having to leave the business and sell it to somebody else, stay involved in the business and yet still grow the business and help the employees then become the owners.
Well, Brett, your business is very technical and science and engineering. What is your background?
I'm actually a chemical engineer. So that's how I got into it originally, was through the chemical engineering.
Well, and we always love to talk to people about the collaborations and the various disciplines that come in to these kind of projects. So what other sort of scientific arenas are some of your employees?
So we have chemists, we have mechanical engineers because we build a lot of things. We have geologists and hydrogeologists because we do drilling and we do subsurface work and we work with groundwater. So all those disciplines come in as chemists, chemical engineers, mechanical engineers, hydrogeologists, and geologists are the primary ones. But anybody with an engineering background, we have some that aren't in those disciplines can still be very helpful in our business.
Well, it's a really interesting business, Brett. And I know it's based in Washington State. Is that right?
That's where we are. That's our state where our ownership is held. Yes.
Okay, but it doesn't keep you from being in Park City. I noticed on your LinkedIn account, it says TRS Group, Park City, Utah. I love it.
Yeah, that happens to be where I am. One of the great things about our company is we're remote. So we have people across the U.S. and they all work from home. So we went remote, 25 years ago before COVID hit, and we've stayed that way since. So COVID was an easier transition for us because everybody works from home and a lot of them travel to the sites. And it gets close to all the sites around the U.S.
Yeah. And then, so I imagine you have warehouses where you keep your electrodes and all your equipment, and that's in Washington State?
Actually not. It's actually a little more in the center of the country. So we have it in Indianapolis where we have our warehouse and a small office because it's a little more central, allows us to get equipment both to the East Coast and the West Coast.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay. Well, just a final question, Brett. I'm interested in the kinds of regulation overseeing contaminated soils, basically, in all of these different countries that you work in. I mean, we like to think that the United States is pretty well regulated in, cleaning up the waste from industry. But could you comment on that and what it seems like around the rest of the world?
Yeah, I sure could. We have similar laws to what they have in Europe. In the U.S., though, we have the EPA regulations that cover the whole country, but every state has their own regulations that are separate and oftentimes stricter than the EPA. Brazil surprisingly has a number of laws. So we have a joint venture in Brazil. And so that's a growing joint venture because they are starting, even though they're kind of a second world country, they're doing quite a bit of cleanup, especially in the São Paulo area. And then I was actually surprised by our Chinese joint venture partner came to us. And I don't know that I ever thought the Chinese would be cleaning up their hazardous waste sites, but this was about 5 years ago when they came to us and we formed a joint venture, and they have run a number of projects, and the Chinese are actually cleaning up their contaminate sites that I didn't think they would do this quickly or early. So it is starting to happen around the world, not in developing countries, but in developed countries for sure.
Right. And then in Europe, the European countries, I would assume, are sort of ahead of us in how they treat contaminated soils, or on par?
Surprisingly, regarding treatment of soils and thermal, the U.S. is ahead of Europe. We always think of Europe as very environmentally focused, but in terms of soil and groundwater, the United States is really the leader worldwide. We do more cleanup and we're more aggressive in cleaning up in most states, because a lot of it's state driven, than they are in Europe. So we're really a leader in this.
Ah, well, that is heartening.
Yeah.
Brett Trowbridge is our guest, and he is the CEO of TRS Group, and he's also a local resident who runs the company from right here in Park City, maybe even sometimes from the ski lift.
I try to get as much skiing as I can when we're there for the winter.
That's right. Okay, Brett, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Again, local resident Brett Trowbridge from the TRS Group. And he did mention a couple of times during the interview about the film Dark Waters, which my only reference that I had was a film like Aaron Brockovich. But Dark Waters is the story of, you know, against DuPont, which ended up paying something like $671 million. Really interesting movie with star power.
Star power, indeed.
Mark Ruffalo.
And a good story.
Yeah. Anne Hathaway. I think I looked it up. I haven't seen it. That'll be my weekend watch. Yeah. But really very interesting what that group is doing. We have a quick reminder about
the Bryce Astronomy Festival. It's coming up June 5th through 8th down at Bryce National Park. They will have, you can't bring your own telescope because what they try and do is, what they actually do is keep people controlled, and they bring in astronomers with their own telescopes. They have lectures, they have events during the day, at night. So be sure and go down. I'm sure it's just, I think it's brycecanyon.org.
Mm-hmm. Bryce Astronomy Festival.
Yes, bryceastronomyfestival.org. We had them on last year. We are hoping to talk to them again here soon before you go, but be sure and go down. And if you do, be sure and take some warm clothes, because even though it's going to be June in the desert, it's going to be cold.
That's right, 7,000 feet. At Bryce. Well, thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. And remember, you can always access archived shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab in Cool Science Radio or wherever you get your podcasts, KPCW Cool Science Radio.